Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled The U.S. and the World Trade Organization, Predictions for What Comes Next, a virtual conversation with Stephen Vaughn. My name is Greg Walsh, and I am Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Stephen Vaughn, a partner in the international trade team of King & Spalding, and a former general counsel for the Office of the United States Trade Representative and acting U.S. Trade Representative. Moderating today is Mr. Daniel Pickard, a partner in the international trade practice and co-chair of the national security practice at Wiley Rhine. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. Mr. Pickard, the floor is yours.
Great. Thanks, Greg. And thanks, everyone, for joining today. As Greg mentioned, I'm Dan Pickard, and I'd like to welcome you to the Federalist Society's program today on the U.S. and the World Trade Organization. I'm very pleased to introduce my friend Stephen Vaughn. As Greg mentioned, Stephen is currently a partner at the international trade team of King & Spalding. Prior to King & Spalding, Stephen completed more than 2 years of service at the General Counsel's Office of the Office of the United States Trade Representative. In that position, he managed a team of government attorneys representing U.S. interests in both trade negotiations and trade litigation. While at USTR, Stephen was directly involved in numerous significant issues, including the new U.S.-Canada-Mexico agreement, actions undertaken by the U.S. against China pursuant to Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, and efforts to revise the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. Importantly, for today's discussion, he also supervised U.S. litigation efforts before the World Trade Organization. In 2017, Stephen also served as the acting U.S. Trade Representative. Before USTR, Stephen spent almost two decades of private practice representing clients in high-profile trade matters. He has a lengthy experience in complex trade litigation before the U.S. International Trade Commission, the U.S. Court of International Trade, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, as well as North American Free Trade Agreement binational panels. Stephen is widely recognized as a leading expert in U.S. trade policy. So with that brief introduction, I'd like to express our thanks to Stephen for participating in this program and begin by asking him if he would give us some background as to the U.S. concerns in regard to the WTO.
Oh, thank you very much, Dan. Thank you for having me. It's great to be able to talk to this group. Yeah, I think for a long time now, going back several administrations, the U.S. has been concerned about what was happening in terms of the dispute settlement process at the WTO. As I think a lot of people on this phone call will be aware, the United States has a constitutional system which makes it very limited in terms of the ability of the Congress to sort of give away the sovereignty of the United States. And when we joined the WTO in 1994, the rules were set up to make very clear that we were only bound by what we had agreed to. And even under those circumstances, the United States retained its independence in terms of whether or not it would comply with those obligations under the WTO. And as everybody commonly knows, when we join a trade agreement, the agreement is not self-executing under U.S. law. Congress makes changes to U.S. law to bring us into compliance with the agreement, and then U.S. policymakers are bound by what's in U.S. law, not what's in a trade agreement. So that was our understanding of the situation as it applied when we joined. If you study the debates on joining the WTO, it's very clear that members of Congress were confident that they had preserved and protected the sovereignty of the United States, and that was important in our decision to join. What happened over the next 25 years is something that most Federalists won't be surprised to hear about, which is judicial activism. We had a series of very aggressive decisions taken by the appellate body of the WTO, which expanded the obligations that the United States was under, and left smaller and smaller areas of policy space for American policymakers. The Bush administration complained about this. The Obama administration had very serious concerns about it, to the point of even blocking one of the appellate body members from being reappointed. And when we inherited the situation, it was very clear that a lot of the people in Geneva simply don't respect the sovereignty and independence of the member states and see the appellate body of the WTO as a kind of world court designed to, that has the power to lay out new rules and new interpretations of trade in much the same way that things operate inside the European Union. That's not something the Americans had ever agreed to. I don't think it's really something that the Americans ever could agree to under our constitutional system. And so we raised these concerns in a number of forums over the last 4 years. We've had extensive conversations about them with every country in Europe, every other major trading partner that we have. I think everybody is very aware of our concerns. And up to this point, those concerns really haven't been adequately addressed. So for now, we don't have an active appellate body. As terms of members expired, the U.S. was unable to agree to appoint new members. So we don't have that at this time. We still have a dispute settlement process, but it's a dispute settlement process that's much more under the control of the members. And that's much more reflective of our governmental system and what we thought we had agreed to, you know, back when we joined the WTO. So these are not just technical trade issues, in my opinion. These are issues that if you care about our governmental system and you care about the basic idea that Americans are supposed to be subject to rules and laws that are approved in a constitutional process by American policymakers, then I think you should be concerned about what was happening at the WTO, because it was a real effort to change, 200 years of American practice and have trade policy be made not by people here, but by people in Geneva. And I think this is going to raise a lot of questions in terms of going forward. What does it mean when we say we want to work with other countries? Everybody wants to work with other countries, but how much of our independence do we give up in order to do so?
Thanks. So you anticipated my first question. I was going to ask about, obviously, the perceived crisis in regard to the appellate body and the blocking of judges and how that process unfolded. I guess maybe if we could move to kind of the current state of play now, where do things stand in Geneva, really, as a result of the appellate body no longer having a quorum?
Well, right now, since the appellate body doesn't have a quorum, there's no a way to appeal disputes. You still have a dispute settlement process. Members can still agree to submit decisions to a dispute panel. And if a panel's decision is accepted by the dispute settlement body, it would still be treated as a legitimate decision. What we don't have now is this sort of, super court, which is what the appellate body had become, which is out there kind of, laying down these kind of broad principles that would change the rules and make it more difficult for members to manage their own trade policies. So that's where it stands for now. Obviously, this is an ongoing process, and we're going to have very serious conversations between us and the rest of the world in terms of how we want to work things out going forward.
So in your opinion, what's got to change at the WTO for the substantive U.S. concerns to be addressed?
Well, so from my perspective, right, we're bound by the Constitution and we're bound by U.S. law. So what happens in a situation, obviously, this isn't like a treaty. The WTO isn't set up by a treaty that's binding directly on the U.S. with a series of agreements, and then Congress passes statutes to make our laws consistent with those agreements. So what we're presented here with a situation is, what if you have a case where there's an international body, and the international body says, we believe the United States is obliged to take certain actions. And if the United States doesn't take those actions, we will authorize other countries to sanction the United States. That's the situation that we've been facing at the appellate body, and it creates major constitutional and political, you know, questions for Americans. Obviously, as a technical matter, the United States still retains the sovereign power to, you know, not comply with those decisions. But you can see how it creates a constitutional temptation here. If policymakers in America want to change a policy or want to go along with a policy that you know, another country likes, they can use WTO disputes and say, well, we have a ruling from the WTO, and we have to follow that ruling. I'm not saying that that's happened. I'm not saying that people have done that. But I am saying that if you want to maintain the clear lines of control where the people are able to know that they're only subject to rules that are approved in a constitutional manner, that it's very important to, you know, be on guard against these kind of very aggressive readings of treaties tied to a dispute settlement process that leads to sanctions for the United States, because I think that raises very serious concerns about whether or not the trade policy of the United States is actually being made by the people who have authority to make that policy under Articles 1 and 2 of the Constitution. So, to me, those concerns have to be addressed. We cannot be party to an agreement that binds us to obligations that no member of Congress and no one in the executive branch actually agreed to. It's just, you know, from an American perspective, you have to think of the agreements as more of a contract. We will live up to what we agreed to in the contract. But I think from the perspective of a lot of other members, they view it as more of a process. You signed on to this process, and now you're bound by whatever result comes out of the process. That's a very difficult, I mean, I don't think that's what we agreed to. And it's very difficult for a country that celebrates Independence Day and has a constitutional form of government to say, in this area of the law, we're just going to do what we're told. So I think that's the heart of the question. And I think, you know, we need to find some way to work together on that. And I think ultimately the rest of the world needs to respect our system and give us the constitutional space that we need so that our trade policy is made in a constitutional manner that's consistent with our laws and history and traditions.
So what have the responses been like from our major trading partners? We've expressed this concern regarding U.S. sovereignty. Has there been a broad range in reactions, or have most of the reactions been uniform?
I think there are countries who recognize that this is an issue. You have a lot of countries out there who have governments that are responsive to the voters and who understand that, you know, it's very sensitive for any democracy to be ordered around by a dispute settlement process that they don't have much of a control over. But at the end of the day, I think most people, it's, you know, we get sued far more than any other country. So no other country really kind of faces the challenges that we do in terms of the amount of cases and the amount of pressure to change our policies that we face. So it's just not as big a priority for some of these other countries as it would be for us. And then the second, then obviously you have other countries that just really disagree, you know, and one of the things I think we're all going to have very robust conversations with friends in Europe in particular is, they have developed a political tradition that is very different from ours, that does not give a lot of weight to the sovereignty of an independent country, that doesn't seem to have our same concerns about the voters and the role of the voters in the policymaking process, and that is much more comfortable having major questions of policy decided in a very technocratic way by people who, from our way of looking at things, don't have the type of legitimacy that we would want to see in somebody who's a lawmaker. And I think you see this coming up a lot in U.S.-EU relations, where the EU argues that the U.S. is bound by some type of international obligation, and the Americans say, no, the only real obligations are the ones that the people agree to. And that's tension between the United States and the European Union. It's something that we're going to have to, understand each other better and talk to each other more and see how we can, work together.
So there's been some reporting in the trade press in regard to the U.S.'s emphasis on the why question, really getting to a satisfactory answer as far as why we're in the position we're at, where certain of our trading partners have said that should be de-emphasized and maybe more of a focus should be placed on what changes need to occur now. I didn't know if you had any thoughts that you wanted to share about those discussions.
Yeah, so let me just explain a little bit about what the point there. So obviously when you're in a situation like this and you say, look, we have real concerns about how this is working, one of the first things that happens is that people come in and say, well, tell us what kind of a fix do you want? And then we can sort of talk about that. But here, it's a tricky issue for the Americans, because when you study the text of the agreement, I think that the people who negotiated it back in the early 90s really did negotiate a lot of protections. For example, it's very clear. I mean, it's clear in the text that the dispute settlement process does not have the power to impose new obligations on members. It's clear from the text that decisions of the appellate body have to be completed and returned to the members within 90 days. It's clear from the text that if you're a member of the appellate body, you get to stay on for one term of 4 years and then another term of 4 years. And then after that, you have to leave. All of these things and other things are very, very clear from the text. They just haven't been enforced. The text has been disregarded, and the appellate body, with the support of a lot of members, has simply failed to give the United States the benefit of the bargain that it agreed to back in the early 90s. So if you come to a lawyer and you say, okay, well, tell us the text that you want in order to alleviate your concerns, well, a lot of that text is already there, and it didn't work. So it would be foolhardy to say, okay, well, given this history, now once you put in a few more pieces of text, that's going to satisfy us. If the old text didn't work, if you have a law, a rule that states very clearly a decision has to be issued within 90 days, and then it turns out they don't issue decisions within 90 days, and those decisions are still regarded as legitimate. Well, I can't write a rule clearer than that. So if that rule is not going to be followed, what rules are going to be followed? So what we started asking was, it's not enough to just talk about textual potential changes. We all have to understand, why did this happen? Why did we create a body that was supposed to work a certain way, and it didn't work out that way? Because until we understand that, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to agree to new changes. You're just, papering over those divisions, and they're just going to reassert themselves, and we're all going to be right back to where we were. So that's the issue. Some countries have engaged with us on that. Other countries have resisted. But to me, we can't just kind of keep talking past each other. It's been 25 years. We need to have a real serious conversation. If other countries are truly committed to the idea that the appellate body can change the obligations that the members thought that they had agreed to, or that the appellate body can fill in gaps that were left deliberately in the agreement, or that the appellate body can, you know, issue clarifying decisions that create new obligations that didn't previously exist. If we have a large number of WTO members who are really committed to those ideas, those concepts need to be put on a table plainly and distinctly. And we need to have a conversation about that, because if that's, I think those are propositions that the Americans are going to find it very, very difficult to agree to.
So I guess that brings us to the big question. Where do we go from here? What steps do you think need to be taken? What steps do you think likely will, in fact, be taken?
Well, one of the nice things about it is that as a practical matter, there's not much evidence that any of this has a huge, that any of the controversy of the WTO has had a huge impact on trade. I mean, obviously now you have issues with the pandemic and you have some other things that have been happening with China. But for the most part, if you look at the data in 2019, you know, compared to 2016, exports were up, imports were up, trade was up. The U.S. economy was doing very, very well. Unemployment was low. Wages were rising. So we have a lot of space here to get the right result. This isn't like a crisis that needs to be, resolved immediately. And I think it makes a lot of sense for us to have an honest conversation with ourselves and with our allies and say, look, we all thought we had reached an agreement in 1994, 1995. Maybe it turns out we were further apart than we thought. Maybe we're not actually ready to have a dispute settlement process with this much power. Maybe it's going to be better if a lot of these issues get resolved through negotiations as opposed to being resolved by us going to arbitration against each other. And maybe that's fine. I mean, so the world trading system, basically did not have binding arbitration for almost 50 years after the end of World War II. And that system did very, very well. And we had years and years of prosperity and growing trade and confidence in market-based systems and obviously a victory in the Cold War. So I think we just have to keep talking to each other and be candid with each other. And if we're not able to reach an agreement at this time, well, then, we have lots of other ways of resolving disputes.
So you touched on actually my next question before, and then maybe we'll open it up for the floor. And I don't know if it would help to tease this out a little bit, but I was going to ask the question that there was a lot of press and a lot of discussion in regard to the fact that this was a quote unquote crisis that come, I think it was December 11th or December 10th, that there was great concern, and some of the reporting was used some very strong language as far as how serious a challenge this was to the whole world order. But on December 11th, there wasn't a whole lot of reporting about, or subsequent to that, maybe a real manifestation of negative impacts as a result of the appellate body not having a quorum. And you did touch on this in your previous answer. I didn't know if you wanted to expand on that a little further as far as why maybe this was perceived to be more of a crisis than it turned out to be, or perhaps why it never was a crisis to begin with.
Well, yeah, I mean, and this is one of the reasons that one of the reasons that I like having this forum to talk about it, because I think these are concepts that a lot of folks here are going to be familiar with. And it's very easy to say, okay, we're going to have disputes. And the best way to deal with those disputes is to have arbitration. And we'll have people will file briefs, and we'll have hearings, and the arbitrators will make rulings, and that'll be how we resolve disputes. But everybody who practices law understands that a lot of disputes are not amenable to arbitration. And in fact, in a lot of disputes, you know, trying for binding arbitration might actually make it more difficult to resolve the dispute. The way I think we ought to be thinking about it is this. If we have a major trade dispute, whether it's with China or whether it's with the EU or whether it's with any other WTO members, there's a lot of ways those things can play themselves out. You can have negotiations. You can go, you know, you can threaten tariffs. You can impose tariffs. They can threaten tariffs. They can impose tariffs. A lot of different things can happen. And there can even be situations where both sides say, you know what, in this case, it would be helpful to have an arbitrator's decision. Let's go to a panel and let's get a decision from an arbitrator. But the point of all of this is to keep the decision-making process in the hands of the place where it should be, which are the elected officials in the United States whose job it is to address these type of questions. And the legitimate, you know, cabinet members and other key players in the executive branch who have these responsibilities as a matter of statute under U.S. law. Most of the time, or in many times, taking something out of the hands of negotiators and putting it in the hands of litigators does not get you closer to a solution. A lot of times it gets you further away from a solution. So I think that what we should be doing is look at this as an opportunity to really think through how do we want to manage relationship in a world where we have two other economies, the EU economy and the China economy, that are almost as big as ours. And I think we're going to find that, you know, the way the administration has been dealing with it through all these different series of trade deals that they've had. And you look at the unemployment figures that I was talking about earlier, you look at what was happening in markets, all these type of financial and economic data points that we had at the end of 2019, that approach to me just works better than an approach where you say, okay, we're turning everything over to the litigators and they're just going to file lawsuits.
Great. So I know we have a particularly large audience today. So maybe, Greg, this could be a good time to open the floor if, Stephen, you'd be so kind to take some questions.
Absolutely. Let's open the floor. We'll now go to our first caller.
Hello, it's Thomas Dillon here, calling guests from Geneva.
Hello.
Hello there. Look, I'm a bit surprised that about the your approach to the making a trade policy. I mean, the WTO is the policy, surely, the idea of a rules-based system for international trade. The United States has made more complaints under the system than any other country, 124, and it's been a third party in 161 disputes. It's even made complaints this year against India, for example. Now, look, it's a fundamental principle of the law of treaties that they should be performing in good faith. If the WTO no longer works for the US, then surely the US should just leave the WTO.
Well, I think the United States has acted in good faith. It wasn't the United States who made the decision that we would disregard the 90-day rule on the appellate body. It wasn't the United States who made the decision that the appellate body would sort of, you know, just disregard, you know, all kind of principles and stuff that we felt that we had agreed to. It wasn't our choice that the appellate body, you know, ignored the warnings of the Bush administration and the Obama administration and lots of members of Congress. It wasn't our choice that the appellate body and the members supporting the appellate body, you know, really refused to seriously engage with the United States on this issue for 3 years. None of that was the responsibility of the United States. We were very clear in 1994 when we agreed to this, when the Congress approved it. And we said at the time, and we said very clearly for 25 years since, we are a sovereign, independent country. We have agreed to certain principles in these WTO provisions. We will live up to those agreements, and we will participate in the process in a good faith manner. But we are not going to be bound to principles and ideas to which we never agreed. We couldn't have been more clear on that. We've been insistent on that from the beginning. So I don't really, I think that, you know, to me, we're the ones who have basically stayed true to what we all agreed to back in 1994-95. Obviously, there are other people who think that they can use this process to force the Americans to adopt trade policies that we don't want to adopt. We never agreed to that. So we're not going to agree to that. And I don't think that's within either the spirit or the letter of the WTO agreement.
Daniel, is there anything you want to go into more detail on while we wait for another caller?
Sure. So taking the moderator's privilege to ask a question, maybe to drill down just a little further. Stephen, there have been a couple of decisions out of the appellate body that commentators in the United States pointed out were particularly egregious, some of which turned on standard of review issues in trade remedy cases. But I didn't know if there were an example or two that you thought might be helpful to illustrate some of the concerns by on the part of the U.S.
Well, the first thing I want to say is that, you know, after I left, USTR put out a very helpful report that goes through, you know, I think it's well over 100 pages, and it goes into great detail about the procedural problems that we had with the appellate body. It goes through a lot of the substantive problems that we had with the appellate body, and it gives specific examples of cases. I'm hesitant to talk about the trade remedies cases because there's a lot of people who tend to act like that's the only concern that America has. And it's very much not the only concern that Americans have. But to follow up on the example that you gave, it's very widely known and very widely recognized that the Americans fought very hard in the negotiations to get language in the text that would make clear that there's not necessarily one correct way to interpret the anti-dumping agreement. There's not necessarily one correct way to interpret the subsidies and countervailing measures agreement, and that there would be policy space given to members so that if provisions were open to multiple interpretations, that would be okay. That was something that was very important to the U.S. The U.S. insisted on it. The U.S. got it. Knowing trade negotiations, I'm sure the U.S. paid a price for that. And it just turned out to be a complete dead letter. You know, once the appellate body got involved, they basically just read that language out of the agreement entirely. And they, you know, changed the way the agreement was interpreted so that there would be one binding way of reading these agreements, no matter what the U.S. Argued for. So that's one example. You know, and many others could be given. Everybody understands that there's a safeguards agreement. The agreement goes into great detail about all the different things that members are supposed to do in order to impose safeguards. A lot of Americans thought that was a very important part of the system. We have a safeguards statute, which we've had for many years. A lot of policymakers thought it was a good alternative in some cases to AD and CVD laws, anti-dumping and countervailing duty laws. And the appellate body has largely just written the safeguards agreement out of the system, construing the agreement in such a way that makes it really difficult, if not impossible, to use measures effectively. In recent years, the agreement, the appellate body has sort of been going into an attack on the countervailing duty laws, which, you know, I can understand maybe people being opposed or concerned about abuses of the anti-dumping laws, but the countervailing duty laws are really there to prevent subsidies. I mean, they're there to encourage, you know, freer, unsubsidized trade. Even those laws don't withstand scrutiny at the appellate body. So you have a situation where the United States is literally signed up to an agreement where people are trying to use the agreement to make it easier for countries like China to subsidize goods for shipment to the United States. So again, that's not something we ever agreed to. So those are just a few examples, you know, and like I said, USTR has many, many other examples in its report.
Great. And I know we've got another question in the queue.
Indeed, we do. Let's go to the next caller.
Oh, hi. This is Christine McDaniel at Mercatus Center. Thank you, Mr. Pickard. Very helpful explanation. So I'm not a lawyer. I'm an economist. So now I just wanted to follow up with one of the moderator's questions to you about, you know, so what needs to occur? And I think you got a little closer to answering that just on the past few minutes. But so it sounds like what needs to occur, you're saying, is basically like a revising of the parameters of the appellate body or a restatement of or renegotiation of the subsidies agreement? Or we just don't know yet? Thank you.
Well, right now, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of what needs to occur, there's billions and trillions of dollars of trade taking place all around the world. There's no evidence that the controversies over the dispute settlement process have changed the actions of buyers and sellers. Like I said, the economy is doing very, very, very well before it was hit by, you know, a once in a century event. And I expect it to do very, very well before the economy. Like I said, we didn't have a binding dispute settlement process in the 80s. We didn't have a binding dispute settlement process in the early 90s or in the 70s or in the 60s. And yet there was huge amounts of trade and huge amounts of competition that was taking place during that period. So I don't see this as a quote unquote crisis that has to be resolved. But I do think that going forward, we have three very, very large economies in the United States, the European Union, and China. We each have very different opinions about how the multilateral system ought to be organized. We each have very different views about concepts like rule of law and sovereignty and independence and the will of the people. And we have to be very realistic in our expectations and in our communications. In the early 90s, I think there was a real sense that with the end of the Cold War, you know, we had come to the end of history and there was really broad agreement among everybody about how things should be organized. Now we know that's not true. And so we're going to have to work with other countries, obviously, as we've done ever since 1789. But again, as we've done since 1789, that has to be done in a manner that's consistent with our Constitution and our laws.
Great. And Stephen, being mindful of the time, there's a political question that I'd like to tee up to the extent that you're comfortable discussing it, and then want to make sure that we've got plenty of time for your concluding remark. So in regard to the political issue, from kind of a conservative perspective, which has been traditionally identified as pro-free trade, but there's also kind of a tension with concerns regarding what are viewed as essentially international activist judges, and also the potential kind of trampling on U.S. sovereignty interests. And I didn't know if you thought there was a way of reconciling those or if you were interested in commenting on that.
Oh, sure. I mean, look, I have a lot of policy preferences, and I'm sure a lot of people on the phone call have a lot of policy preferences. But to me, one of the things that, you know, to use the term conservative or to use the term federalist, I mean, I consider myself to be a conservative and I consider myself to be a federalist. I think one of the things that we share in common is an idea that, you know, it's a commitment to certain processes. It's a commitment to doing things a certain way. And it's a belief that America has to act in a manner that's consistent with its Constitution. And the Constitution makes clear that authority over trade was given to the Congress, and authority over foreign relations was given to the President. And the Congress and the President are responsible to the American people, you know, through elections and through our constitutional system. That's the system that we have. And I think to say, well, I don't trust the Congress, I don't trust the President, I don't trust our elected officials, I'm afraid that they disagree with me on this big policy matter, So what I want to do is take that power away from the U.S. government, and I want to give it to a body in Geneva that will order American officials to do the policies that I prefer. I think that's a very dangerous slope for people in the Federalist Society, or for anybody, to be honest, to go down. Because once you start invoking those type of processes, why can't we have an international body that orders us to do things in the name of climate change? Why can't we have an international body that orders us to do things in the name of foreign policy reasons or international law? It's just a mistake, in my opinion, to go down that path. And that's why, to me, this is not really just an issue of trade policy. It's really a question about how does the country work? How is the country governed? If you have to sit down with somebody and they want to know, why can't we have this type of policy? Why can't we have that type of policy? I don't want the answer to be, well, yeah, we Americans all want to do that, but people in Geneva tell us we can't do that. I think that would be a mistake.
So, again, I want to be respectful of your time. I'm extraordinarily appreciative of you making time to speak with us today. But as I said, I want to make sure that we left time for you. If there were any last observations that you wanted to share regarding where the U.S. is, where the Geneva is, or any concluding remarks, I think the floor is still yours.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the questions. I appreciate the fact that people have listened in. I appreciate the chance to be here and to do this. Look, this seems like, I'm sure for a lot of you, sort of a minor set of kind of technical questions. And it wouldn't surprise me if for a lot of you, these questions of process are overshadowed by the substantive questions of what kind of a trade policy we're going to have. And I can certainly understand why a person who has very, very strong views in terms of things like, you know, free trade or tariffs or what kind of a trade policy we should have would maybe lose patience with these concerns over whether or not we're getting there through a constitutional process or whether we're being ordered to do things through what, you know, I think is a non-constitutional process. But I would really urge you to recognize, you know, the gravity that's at stake. On the one hand, we have this huge pessimism in a lot of people in town that we can't trust elected officials to make trade policy because they're all inherently protectionist and we'll all be back to Smoot-Hawley. That's simply false. The people who voted for Smoot-Hawley were crushed in the elections in 1932. That policy was reversed in 1934, and we never went back to it. This idea that you can't trust elected officials or you can't trust the voters to know what's in their own interest is just not true. It's not borne out by history. It's not borne out by the facts. We never had a binding dispute settlement process, you know, for over 200 years. And in those 200 years, we became the richest and the freest and the most successful country in the world. So this idea that economy and trade and all of these things are dependent on seven people in Geneva is simply not correct. On the other hand, what is concerning and what is true is that not all countries share our commitment to creating a government that is responsive to the voters and to creating a government that is constrained by concepts of, you know, found in the Bill of Rights. And if we start going down this road of creating international bodies that tell Americans what to do in various areas of life, we will do, I'm afraid we will be opening a door to other areas of intrusion and regulation that could create significant problems for us. I think the thing to do about, you know, what I would sort of urge people here to do is to let the negotiating process play out. The United States has very good negotiators looking out for our interests. The Europeans and the Chinese and the other countries will be trying to work through this as well. I think everyone is committed to a flourishing global economy. I think everybody wants, efficient markets where hard work and innovation is rewarded. And I think we're better off, letting that process play out, but letting it play out within the context of a system that respects our constitutional tradition and does not require us to submit to decisions or interpretations with which we never agreed. So that's my comment, and I appreciate everybody's time and attention.
Thanks again, Stephen. It is very much appreciated. I think that concludes our presentation or our program. And Greg, I'll kick it back to you.
Thank you. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.